We're here today to have the last in this series of roundtables discussing various issues related to orphan works, which we identify as works where you cannot find copyright owner. I started looking at this issue probably 23 years ago. Only then I called it unlocatable copyright owners. Orphan works has more panache. In any case, my interest started when I was asked by the Library of Congress to work on a digital project. Back then, there weren't very many. And a decision was made that we were not going to reproduce or display anything without the permission of the copyright owner, even though, because it was an experiment, we probably could have relied on fair use. And we did it because we really wanted experience in what does it take to find a copyright owner, and then when you find them, what does it take to get permission? It was a very interesting exercise. I spent a long time not being able to clear any rights in soundtracks of motion pictures because nobody knew who owned what rights. And we resolved them by getting the major studios to agree not to object to what we were doing, but we had to mute the soundtrack. I spent 2 years getting an agreement with a news company for the July 4th, 1976 news broadcast. I spent months trying to figure out who was the owner of a motion picture, and a company kept telling me it wasn't it, but it had, in fact, renewed the work only 2 years earlier. And after many conversations, they agreed that they did, in fact, own the work. So it's always intrigued me. If somebody wants to use a work, what do you have to go through in order to be able to use it? And when Jewel joined the Copyright Office staff as Assistant Register for Policy and International Affairs, this was an issue that he seemed to warm to quickly. And so it was with great delight that I gave him the project. And we were very fortunate in the fact that Senator Hatch and Senator Leahy in the Senate, now chair and ranking on the intellectual property, I'm shortening it, subcommittee now in the Senate, and of course Senator Leahy, the ranking member of Judiciary, expressed a great interest and actually said, do a study and make legislative recommendations. The House expressed interest but didn't quite go that far. So our mandate is to do a study of the issues and to, if we believe it's appropriate, make legislative recommendations. We made a decision to look at the problem broadly, not to look at it narrowly, to see who is affected by not being able to locate copyright owners and what's involved in their searching for those owners and trying to get permission to use them. The good news about being the boss is I now can turn this over to Jewel because he's the one that's closest to the study and he has formulated all of the questions that we're going to pose today. Before I do that, I just want to go through who is here from the Copyright Office. Obviously, Jewel, to my immediate left, is the Associate Register for Policy and International Affairs, and he came to us from Arnold and Porter, but he had served a one-year kind of stint with us, and I was delighted he wanted to come back. To my immediate right is David Carson, the General Counsel of the Copyright Office. He also came to us from private practice. And let's see, and Jewel's staff, who are the key people who work on this day in, day out, to David's right is Oliver Metzger, who also came to us from private practice. And on the far left is Matt Skelton, who actually came to us from law school. And he is one of the newer attorneys. He also works in policy and international affairs. Any of you get involved in Section 1201 and exemptions for the ability to circumvent access controls should have met the person to Jewel's immediate left, Rob Kasanek. We in the office call him Mr. 1201. and he will be working on this project. And I know that Jewel is probably going to ask you to introduce yourself, but let me turn this over to Jewel. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Beth. Let me start by telling you a little bit about the format and just one housekeeping note, a scheduling change that we're going to undertake, and then we'll have everyone introduce themselves and tell us who they're here on behalf of. And first, we'd like to start the afternoon panel 1 hour earlier. I think the schedule called for it to start at 2. We'd like to start it at 1 o'clock so that we can maximize the time out here since we only have one day. So it will run from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock. The second topic, which is the consequences of an Orphan Works designation, we'll probably do that in the 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock hour. We'll spend that extra hour on that topic because that seemed to be, from last week's roundtables, a topic that had a lot of discussion and a lot of material to get through. So I believe there's only, I think everyone who is on that second panel is here in the room, at least on the panel or in the room. So just everyone be aware that we're going to have a one-hour lunch break instead of a two-hour lunch break. The format for this roundtable will follow the same that we did last week, which is one of us will introduce the topic with a brief statement and then start with a question and then solicit comments from everyone in response to that question. And we found that last week anyway, the follow-up questions and discussion followed relatively naturally from that format and seemed to give everyone a fair shot at speaking their mind and getting their views across on the wide range of issues that this whole project raises. So we'll follow that as well. Now let's go around and start here on my left, and everyone can introduce themselves and let us know who they're here on behalf of and who they're representing. Try as much as possible to speak into a microphone for a couple reasons so that the audience can hear, and also it's key to our transcription process. Everything here is being transcribed, and a transcript will be available on our website. And we understand that the Berkeley folks are kind enough to have made it, will be making a recording of this session, and the audio will also be available on their website and probably ours at some point as well. So speaking into the microphone is a little bit of annoyance, but it's key for us to record everything that's going on.
Hi, my name is Megan Lee, and I'm with the Defense Language Institute Foreign Language Center. I'm with the Curriculum Development Division, and I do editing and copyrights.
Alexander McGillivray from Google.
Barbara Gregson from Miller Gregson Productions. I do independent film research, rights and clearance work for over 25 years representing... Actually, I'm a member of Focal and Clear and a board member of the International Documentary Association. So I'm trying to represent all of those independent film researchers so everybody hires to find this stuff.
Ken Hammond, J. Paul Getty Trust
in Los Angeles. Carl Johnson, Brigham Young University, the Copyright Licensing Officer at the University.
Brewster Kale, Digital Librarian of the Internet Archive.
Jerry McBride, I'm representing the Music Library Association.
Dwayne Butler, I'm the University of Louisville University Library.
Michael Donaldson, representing the International Documentary Association, Film Independent, with about 10,000 independent filmmakers.
David Eber, I'm with Houghton Mifflin Company.
Bruce Funkhauser, I'm with Copyright Clearance Center.
Chris Sprigman, I teach at University of Virginia Law School. I'm here on behalf of Creative Commons and Save the Music.
Gary Strong, the University Librarian at UCLA.
Christine Sund, University of Oregon. I'm here representing College Art Association and Visual Resources Association and also independent artists.
Maureen Whalen, Associate General Counsel at the J. Paul Getty Trust, and I'm here to speak about the art museum perspective on this.
Stephen Gottlieb, Recording Industry Association of America.
Brian Schottlander, University Librarian at UC San Diego and President-elect of the Association of Research Libraries.
And we've also received word that Mark Meyerson and Gail Silva will be attending, but they'll be somewhat late to the proceedings. We'll have them introduced when they arrive. Let me. Our first topic is identification of orphan works, and we're going to spend the morning on this. The idea here is that based on the submissions, the written submissions which we've received, there is a general agreement, it seems, among most participants that the beneficiaries of a system that we might put into place will have to undertake some sort of search to find the copyright owner. And when they fail to find the copyright owner after making that search, they get the benefits of the system, whatever that may be. Once you go beyond that very high level, beneath that very high level, I should say, there's a wide range of proposals on exactly what that search should entail. They seem to run a spectrum where on one side it's a very ad hoc, case-by-case, flexible approach where with a generalized standard of reasonably diligent search of some sort that's decided on a case-by-case basis based on all the circumstances. On the other side of the spectrum, there's a more formalistic, categorical approach that says there should be a registry, even a mandatory registry, of copyright owner information that is the only place that someone might have to search for copyright owner information. And if the owner is not locatable through that formalistic or registry-based approach, then the reasonably diligent search is completed and the user gets the benefit of the designation of an orphan work. And then in between those two extremes, there are a lot of different hybrid measures, if you will, where people are proposing voluntary registration systems that are part of a diligent search but not the complete realm of a diligent search, to other types of mechanisms, including user-based registries where users identify their proposed use of a work that has to be checked by copyright owners. And all of that is part of a mix that determines whether the user made a reasonably diligent effort to locate the copyright owner. So in this topic, we'll explore some of the details about those and various proposals and get your views on the pros and cons of those approaches and all the various facets of those approaches. What we're most interested in, and this is a generalized theme for the questions that we ask and the information we're looking for, in doing these kinds of studies and analyzing these proposals, some may take a sort of cynical and negative view of it, but we like to find out what the downsides to any proposal are. In your written comments, you've done a very good job, I think, of explaining what the positives and the benefits of any proposal might be. But what we'd like to explore with you is what happens if we adopted your approach, what would be the potential pitfalls or problems that might arise, and how you might propose to solve them or get over them or balance them with the pros and the benefits of your approach. So with that in mind, let me start the first question with the notion that the user should take a reasonably diligent search and that be a flexible standard, not categorical, is one that's widely held by a lot of variety of interests on both the traditionally owner side and traditional user side. The notion that the only standard be a general one of reasonably diligent under the circumstances. That's the efforts that someone has to make in order to identify a work as being orphaned and therefore receive the benefits of the system. The opening question is, for those who propose that kind of flexible case-by-case approach, what do you see as the downsides of that approach? What would you identify as the potential pitfalls that we might run into if we were to recommend and Congress were at some point to adopt that kind of approach? So for anyone who's proposed to this type of flexible approach, if you could explain for us what you see as the downsides, that would be helpful. But before you do, let me just give Mark Meyerson, who just joined us, a chance to introduce himself and tell everyone who he's representing. Okay, so the question is downsides to a flexible, reasonable efforts, reasonable diligence approach. Christine and Steve.
Certainly the downside is that there's going to be still uncertainty. And the uncertainty is what a lot of people are trying to avoid. So what we're looking for is a way that flexibility can also address uncertainty and give us assurances with what we're afraid to do.
Steve is next.
Another problem is the potential to fall into the belief that there is a one-size-fits-all system. This is one of the reasons why we advocate a sectoral approach to this. Having industries get together, share their expertise, decide what would be appropriate due diligence and appropriate situations for appropriate works.
Yeah. the lack of certainty, and I believe what you were saying is what has become crystal clear, and that is that the searches are so different for different kinds of material that you really would need guidelines put down by somebody of what a reasonable search is for music, what it is for film clips, what it is for other things. So you'd have some guidance for people conducting the search.
Brewster?
From the library and archives perspective, which is the only thing that I bring up, there's some really tricky things around digital materials that I'd like to bring up, that sometimes you can find somebody that was the author or the owner of the work, but there's nobody home to talk to. Let me bring up an example. These are tapes made by a researcher of the United States of the Election 2000 websites. It was made at Digital Equipment Corporation before it was bought by Compaq, and then it was bought by HP. And I can find somebody that will at least answer the phone call the first time, but not the second time, to ask, what can I do with it? If there's not a commercial viability, it's hard to get somebody to do an ad hoc negotiation around something that they don't really care about, that they can only get in trouble for. So it's an interesting case of the what happens when you search, find, but they don't want to talk to you. And that's not just because I'm not bidding high enough. It's just it doesn't make any sense to them. It comes up very clearly in the software area, where you can find somebody that says, oh yeah, we made that software, but can you make a copy of it for your archive and make it available? I'm not really sure. I'd have to look back at the contracts, and I have no idea. Don't ask me. So the case where you can find people, but you can't get anything going, I think it's somewhat close to what Mary Beth brought up. And let me just bring up one other example, which is close to my heart. My grandfather's book, which is, I have one copy. I have two sons. I'm told by lawyers that one kid gets it and the other one doesn't, even though it's out of print for 50 years. But it's on McGraw-Hill. But no one in my family has the contracts to find out whether it ever reverted. So there's nobody at McGraw-Hill who could care less about this book, but we do. So there's a market failure that's even beyond sort of what this search thing is. So it's more complicated than you think, unfortunately, for we archives and libraries.
This is legion in the arts, in visual art. It's not only that we don't know who the owner is, but you also have people who deny any ownership even when there is a name, or they say, no, that we have never published it, and in fact it has been published. The whole business of what is published and unpublished in the arts is a huge, huge issue. So tracking down ownership and rightful ownership is a big obstacle for us.
David and then Dwayne.
Just to respond to one of the points that Brewster made, I think that there's different scenarios that are being discussed there, and they should be kept separate, because one of them seems to me appropriate for an orphan work solution, and one doesn't. You can go around, you can try to find people, you can have various luck either getting permission or even finding the person. It seems to me that if you find the copyright owner and the copyright owner is not cooperative or is confused or just doesn't want to talk to you, that takes it entirely out of the orphan works scheme, because that is not an unlocated owner, and that's simply a case where you have someone who for whatever reason doesn't feel like licensing. And it seems to me that kind of scenario should be kept out of what we're talking about here. When you have a situation where you talk to somebody, they don't know who owns the rights, they can't figure it out, and you actually can't discover who it is, that is an orphan work situation. And some of the kind of histories or anecdotes about these things sometimes mush these things together, but I think they should clearly be kept separate. So,
Dwayne is next.
From the standpoint of
any open work solution needs to deal with those kinds of resources. And I'm not convinced a guidelines approach would work, but I am convinced that if there's some flexibility and reasonableness in the way that it's applied, that we can deal with those kinds of users. And then the other issue I'd like to just tag on to that question, I think sometimes the person doesn't respond and you haven't located the right person. You might have thought that you located the right person, but still they're unlocated because it's not right person, then they're not going to respond in that context.
I think I had Steve next and then Chris.
I just want to echo what David said and say that silence is not consent. You might have trouble finding a person, or the person ultimately might just be a curmudgeon and not want to help you. But there are exclusive rights that we have to maintain, and this really is outside the orphan work system as we're talking about it.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it is clearly outside the orphan work system. So Brewster brings up an important point, and I'd like to try to figure out what the categories are here. One category is when you locate an owner and he or she says no. And I think the copyright law should give them the right to say no, either because they don't they have plans to exploit it themselves, or for some personal idiosyncratic reason, they just don't want you to exploit it. Another is the copyright owner that can't be located. Okay, so those are the two polar cases. And there I think we would all agree that, you know, that is the heartland of the orphan works problem, is an owner who, after some kind of search, and, you know, we're going to talk about what kind of search, can't be located. That's certainly the heartland. A tough intermediate case is the person who you contact who perhaps doesn't know if he's the owner, because ownership is subject to some contractual agreement that was long ago, you know, thrown out. That's a tough intermediate case. What do you do in that case? Well, I mean, the policy goal here, I think, should be to establish some kind of proxy for when a work is orphaned, when a work is abandoned, when use is not being made of it, and use could be made without harming the ownership interest that the copyright law is there to protect. And that intermediate case that Brewster posits is not so easily thrown out of the orphan works category. That is likely to be a fairly large category. I've had personal experience in that category, and it's a troubling one to me, because ownership, even for people who might be owners, is not always self-evident.
Yes, I think one thing that Mary Beth referred to originally was how much time and how difficult it may be to find a copyright owner. And that in and itself is a problem, especially for organizations with very limited resources. So I think that one of the things that, rather than saying that we need maybe perhaps only one registry for copyrighted works, at least we should be able to come up with some sort of clear and identifiable and limited criteria that people searching for a copyright owner would be able to apply with certainty, so that they would know that they could either go ahead and use the work or not use the work. And I think in that case, it would benefit both the copyright holders as well as the potential users of the copyrighted work.
A large part of my law practice is in the clearance of films, and there's no question this is a big problem. None whatsoever, but I think, all due respect, it clearly is not an orphan works problem. It's horribly frustrating to come to somebody, and either because it's economically inconsequential or they're not sure they have the rights, so what can they grant? But it's not an orphan work. You've identified who the owner is. What I usually do is try and get a quitclaim, as Mary Beth was talking about, or a letter saying, we don't think we own it, and we're not going to bother you if you make this use of it. But it's not an orphan work. And it seems to me if we try to lay that problem in on the clear orphan work problem, that we're sort of overloading the boat before it ever leaves the harbor, and there's a good chance it'll sink before it gets very far out at sea.
As I was preparing for today, I began to think about what an orphan work is. And I came to the conclusion that we're talking about two different things. We're talking about lost children and orphans, true orphans. The lost child being something that has dots leading to an end, but they're not clear. but the orphan doesn't even have a dot. So, again, the idea that we can overload the boat is so true, and I think we're talking too much about stuff that can be handled with other aspects of the law. The law is already written to cover a lot of issues, and fair use might be invoked in some cases, or it may be a situation of public domain in the end. But let's look at orphan works for what they really are and not be overloaded with everything else.
So if you'll permit me, I want to take us on a little excursion. The approach that you have outlined and the approach that we've been speaking about has to do with property rights. That's perfectly appropriate, I think. On the other hand, I like the notion of a nuanced approach that divides the problem set into sectors. There are clearly sectors that have long-term interests in maintaining and exploiting their rights, the rights under the law. For lots of works, though, that we describe as orphan works, where either the record-keeping has been, the transmission of information about the work has been poor, the contracts have been lost, the owners, their heirs, assigns, legatees, agents, and so forth have disappeared, don't know they have the rights. There's a raft of opportunities there for bureaucracy, for more money being spent, and so forth. We have suggested in our submission, and I want to bring this up because I know there are about 700 submissions and recount it for you. We have suggested a much different approach, which goes to the use of regulation, the use of the law to benefit the citizenry, appropriately recognizing property rights, but limiting them in an interesting way. Our proposal is to say that an orphan work is a work that has been out in has been published for 28 years. And if it's not in print, if it's not currently accessible through its originator, it might be determined to be a work that is lost, orphaned. And then we could make use of it for not-for-profit purposes, for research, for teaching, for study, for analysis, and make use of it in digital form or whatever form. And if someone came up and said, by the way, I'm the owner and I don't want this to be available in the form that you've transmitted it, there'd be a quick takedown procedure without a huge penalty. And I think the question of penalty is important regardless of what the approach is. If the penalty is overwhelming, then we won't make use of the material. The citizenry will not benefit from the ideas and expressions. It would be a disaster. It would be what we have now. Recognizing that the records, some of them are very poor, especially going back in time. No one contemplated this sort of situation that we have now, and the opportunities that we have now to benefit education, K-12, benefit higher education, benefit innovation. We should be taking another look at this rather than the strictly sort of embroidery on the existing situation. We should approach this with the idea that the citizenry ought to benefit from whatever proceeds.
We'll be discussing the remedies and limitations on remedies that might be available in a later topic. But anyone who wants to react to a different approach, which I mentioned is one that says after a fixed number of years, the work is presumptively orphaned if it's not in print, those kinds of things, please feel free to react to what Michael has said or have some other viewpoints. I've got Brewster first, and then Joe, and then I think Chris had his hands up.
I think it's interesting to distinguish non-commercial use and also in an environment where notice and takedown works. So in those two things are kind of interesting, and don't want to get into your remedies issue. But let me go back through a couple areas that are particularly problematic, I think, for the idea of let's write off the things where things are confusing, at least in terms of this proceeding. Because I think we can handle it without being sinking a boat. Maybe not. That's up for you to decide. Let's take some of the digital works. We are best known for collecting web pages. We've collected web pages from about 50 million different websites, 50 million, and we've collected about 40 billion pages over the last 9 years. So this is a large-scale effort to go and collect these materials. We, at one point, tried to contact website owners and ask them, hey, what do you think? We were shut down very fast for writing spam. And there were spam filters set up, and it was like, no, you know, we're not spammers. But that wasn't very well. So we tried basically doing what Alta Vista and within the web community is sort of presumptively do it, opt out, which seems to be common within that world, and it worked fairly well. And with the combination of a few things, it's digital works that are very new, right? So these are 28 years old, but I really like the idea that they're in certain media types, there could be this sort of bring back Ben Franklin's 28 years. It's non-commercial use, and notice and takedown works. And in those circumstances, which may help make it a section of the boat that doesn't sink, I think we can get huge numbers of amounts of cultural materials preserved and provided access to in such a way that people aren't upset.
Okay, I had Joe next on the list.
Yeah, I know you all seem to be dealing with it on a little bit different level, and I wanted to kind of paint a picture of what we deal with every day in the retailer business. In our stores, and I'm sure a lot of you are Walmart shoppers, we have machines in there where you can bring in an old family photo, put it on there, and copy it. What we run into mainly is just that scenario where you've got a great customer who brings in an old photograph of their great-great-grandparents taken back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and they just want a copy of it for their family album or distribute to their rest of their family. And we can't copy it because our policy not only supports the copyright law, but it goes beyond it. If it looks like a duck, smells like a duck, walks like a duck, it's a duck, we don't copy it. Regardless of what the details are and, you know, whether or not it qualifies under the infamous Mickey Mouse copyright law. We don't put any kind of time frame on it. So we run into situations where we may have pictures that are back from the 20s where we will upset a customer and say, we can't copy it, we're sorry. Now, to that point, we've got pretty savvy customers that go out on the internet, they pull the laws, and they say, well, if it's over a certain amount of age, you should copy it, et cetera. And we know we do more than that. Our situation is the fact that we need immediacy in the solution or immediacy in finding the owner. And a lot of times we have people where we direct them to go to the, you know, if it's in a small town where Walmarts are, we have them go down to the central office or the county courthouse, and we find out the photographer's been dead for 50 years. The business has been defunct for a long time. There is no family tree history to trace it down to. So at that point, it's purely an orphan work. Nobody even knows who the owner is or who the photographer might have been back then. So we're in a situation where we've got those kind of pieces sitting in front of us where, the customer's upset, and rightfully so, because they can't get a family photograph copied. And we're in a situation as a retailer where we'd like to do nothing more than take their money, but we can't because of our policy and the law. So that puts us in a little situation. You know, it's more of a basic thing, and I know y'all deal with a lot more high-end pieces than that, but that's what we deal with every day is the customer standing in front of you at the counter, who all of you may be standing there at a counter with a photograph that I can't do a darn thing about, and I can't help you, and I do like to do nothing more than to help you and do what I got to do. So, I mean, in that sense, I bring that up only because a lot of pieces y'all have been talking about are more of a very intricate level. You know, we deal it on a daily basis, more of a basic level, and in a representation of the Photo Marketing Association, it's not just Walmart's position that we have this situation. It's all the retailers, and we all try to deal with it on the same level where we try to support both sides of the fence. Like I said, we'd like nothing more than to take the money, but we also understand the copyright law, and we also understand there's pieces in place to support it. So it's not easy at all on the customer side of the fence, and I agree with the gentleman at the end of the table that it's got to be, I think the solutions have got to be looked at from the end consumer standpoint and not so much satisfying our standpoint, because we're the ones that are just kind of the advocate of the customer out there, and we need to kind of take care of what they want, not what we want.
Chris was next on the list.
So why should we react to Michael's suggestion of a 28-year period? Creative Commons and Save the Music favor
an approach. I mean, our period's a little different. It's 25 years, but it's close. And we did that because we think that's a rational approach given the depreciation rate of copyrighted works. And let me explain what I mean by that. If you look at Copyright Office data on registration and then renewal, one thing you notice is that of works registered during the period where you can actually compare registration and renewal data, the vast majority are not renewed 28 years later. So if 85 to 90% of works are not renewed 28 years later, you can take that data and you can calculate at least an approximate depreciation rate for the economic value of that work. And what you see is after about a quarter century, you know, 9 out of 10 or so works don't have significant economic value remaining in them. If they had an economic value early, it's gone away. It's been exhausted. So maybe a quarter century or so, 28 years, is a good proxy for the vast majority of works that had economic value in the first place, not having it anymore. And at that point, the interest in public access is just as strong in many cases, but the interest in exploiting exclusive rights has often attenuated substantially. And that's, in our proposal, the trigger for an orphan work system to be put into place after, in our proposal, 25 years. If your work still has economic value, if the exclusive rights granted by copyright are valuable to you as a means of appropriating that value, hold up your hand and tell the Copyright Office that my work is valuable and I want to retain all the rights that the copyright law currently gives me. If your work is not valuable at that 25-year point, if it neither had any market value as of any point thus far or that market value has been depreciated away, then you don't need to register. It's a voluntary registry, but if you don't, your work is exposed to what we call a default license, which is people can use it, they pay a fee, but there's a kind of statutorily determined fee. So we are very much on board with Michael's approach in terms of the waiting period. We have a little bit different mechanism, but the intent is I think the same.
Gary, and then is it Jerry?
I'd like to echo on that, particularly in the music and in the photographic arena. We've been working very diligently in preparing, creating an archive of Latin music that is all over 28 years old, from 78, trying to search down who owns the rights to that, where they were very small labels, mostly sold to unknown sources. It is virtually impossible to run them down, and yet as we've developed the archive, we have people from the Latin community who are discovering music and their own heritage all over again in places that they never realized it was still present. And so a part of the university environment is where we're trying to not only preserve and capture these resources, but to replace them back into to a new set of community users where there's not a great deal of commercial interest. We would very much like to see a system where if indeed there were a commercial value and someone came forward, take it down, deal with it in some other fashion, but not to lock up the corpus of the rest of the archive so that no one can use it on fear of there being some kind of problem down the way. And that certainty, uncertainty issue of your question is really critical for us. If you go to the other side where we have massive numbers of manuscript collections where there are diaries, photographs, other kinds of things, and I think in particular of our growing and very large archive of Japanese relocation camp material where it is virtually impossible to trace down who took a photograph. Often the families are unidentifiable in diaries that were written and not otherwise identified in a number of the archives that we're receiving. To have to lock that kind of stuff up so that no one can learn from what went on in that period of history, I think it does not do the public service, nor does it do the university service.
Time limit would be really very helpful. In the case of sound recordings, this is particularly problematic for older recordings. In Section 301C, sound recordings before 1972 are exempted, which means that they from the copyright laws, which means they're subject to the copyright laws of all 50 states. Yet most of the sound recordings were probably marketed and sold nationally. This basically locks up all the sound recordings from the beginning of recorded sound to 1972 until 2067. If you can imagine our earliest cylinders trying to research the copyrights on something over 100 years old, where there had been numerous companies going out of business, merging, being sold, it really creates a situation where some of these very early and very sometimes fragile materials are left to sort of languish, and they may no longer be around. It's part of our cultural heritage to bring these out, and that's what we hope to do with libraries. But these very old works that clearly have little or no commercial value at all are sort of sitting there.
Can I ask a question that you just raised? You're talking about pre-1972 sound recordings, and you're talking, what I think about is searching the record company or the performer, I guess, the recorded sound side. What do you do about, do you do anything with regard to the music that may be embodied in those sound recordings?
Well, that's another area that's problematic for libraries, because in section 108I, I think, the underlying musical work is not available for copying by libraries for various purposes, because music is exempted from those. So, again, the copyright on the underlying music may not be as long, but it's still pretty long. So you'd have to research both the underlying musical work and the sound recording itself.
Okay, I have Alex and then Carl.
Making the profit on the work, that again would be great from our perspective. I guess the thing that I would question is whether nonprofits have a particular lock on that, or whether we should be thinking more specifically about the best way to get the most amount of work out there and useful to people.
Carl.
I wanted to make a comment on two subjects. One to the inquiry about music works. Very much so. There's three elements, obviously, and at least three elements. Most often, three elements in musical works, as we know, the musical score and the word lyrics and the sound recording. And our work, those are all treated equally independent. That is, they all require copyright analysis and the due diligence and all that we're talking about. So in our environment, just to answer your specific inquiry, all three elements are dealt with. Now, another subject that I'd like to return to is the underlying initial definition of an orphan work. And I'd like to return to the notion of
what many have commented on as being unidentifiable, unlocatable, and unresponsive. And I'd like to, even though it's a dicey path to go down in trying to define unresponsiveness and make it fair and equitable to both sides, it is a very real issue in terms of trying to, at least from the university perspective, of looking at the public good, the community interest in a work, and realizing that you may have located the owner, you believe that you've located the owner, but you haven't. They just will not respond at all to the inquiry. So you really don't know if you've identified the correct owner. And so I think there is reason to put in the basic definition, this matter of unresponsiveness.
Joe, what's next?
I just wanted to comment on the time frame. In a lot of people, it seems like the time frame will work fine. I mean, in a lot of the music situations, you've got archives, recordings, you have pretty good date stamps on that. In the photographic piece of it, from our side, it's really hard to keep that time frame on it, and that's why at Walmart we've always supported before the Mickey Mouse copyright went into effect. It was a 75-year piece. We did. Mary Beth, you don't like that term, do you? Sorry.
I've heard it many times.
That's what it's lovingly known as in our area.
It's painful.
But before, when it was 75 years, we actually didn't even use the 75-year piece, too. We erred on the side of being good for the photographer. If we couldn't verify it was 75 years, we just said, no, it's professional, we won't do it. Part of the issue we run into now on it is whether it's 25 or 28 years. I mean, that brings you down to 1977 and 1980. I want you all to think about if you have kids who are 18 to 20 years old and working at a retailer store part-time just for fun money, are they really going to care or have the interest to know whether or not the picture was taken in 1976 or 1978? And, you know, how are they going to verify that? You're not going to do it unless there's a stamp on it. And then when you get into that other situation like I'm talking about where it may indeed be orphaned from a characteristic of the photographer's dead or gone or moved away or nobody can be found, then what do you do in that case? And again, I'll go back to the customer at the counter where the picture can be, 25, 26 years old of maybe them in high school or their mother, father, whatever, and you get into that situation where, again, you're standing there wanting to make something for a personal use, private use, and it's hard to figure out from the time frame perspective what to do. And, what do you tell the customer at that point? So, again, I kind of go back to really a practical situation and making it easy for those folks.
Let me just ask a question related to the notion of using some sort of time frame or an imprint status of a work as a determinant. The question, I think, is in many of these types of scenarios, I think those proposals, and maybe I'm wrong and correct me if I am, those proposals make those sort of threshold requirements, whether a work has been in print, whether it's been in print for a certain number of years. And one of the things we hear a lot is that under the current system, the determination of whether something's published versus unpublished is very difficult to make. Would it be the case if you had sort of fixed requirements of these sorts, would that just add to the uncertainty in a sense because you would be potentially squabbling with someone over whether something has been in print or not, or whether it's been in print for 28 years or 30 years or 26 years or that. And if these are threshold requirements, they could really, from a user's perspective, if they lose on that argument, if they lose an argument whether it's in print or not or it's what the time frame might be, they wouldn't get the benefit at all of any system. I think one of the arguments people make in favor of a flexible system is you could very well have an orphan work that's only 10 years old, and you don't have to get into questions, and I think we'll discuss this a little bit more when we talk about published versus unpublished, that you can avoid unclear and uncertainty over threshold requirements like in print, published versus unpublished time frame. Am I on the right path there? Is that something people are thinking of, or how do people react to that? Let's start with David, and then Christine, and then Chris, and then Michael.
I agree with what I take to be the sort of the presumption of that question, which is that if you have a bunch of other threshold issues that have to be met before a particular use will be permitted under this, you're going to just add to the level of investigation. You'll have threshold investigations before you do your later investigation, and you've actually made the problem, well, I don't know if you made it worse, but you certainly haven't made it any better. So I think that, and when we get to unpublished, I don't believe those distinctions should be, there should be these threshold determinations based on the age of the work, based on the published status of the work, based on the out-of-print or not status of the work for those reasons. Let me just say something that sort of relates to that and relates to a lot of things that have been said. I represent Hope Mifflin, and we are, like some people at this table, but not everybody, we are both a copyright owner, many things, but we're also a heavy copyright user of other people's works. And so we come to this with a, you know, balance in this thing is just very important for us and for our authors as well, since they themselves often get permission for their stuff that we publish with them. It strikes me that some of the proposals that would essentially, well, for one thing, that would make the privilege or whatever we'd call it rest on the nonprofit for-profit distinction is not really going to be feasible in a market economy as we have now. But also these ideas that there are these proxies, years, out-of-print status, that proxies for can you locate someone are going to essentially divest certain people of their copyright rights. And I don't see a reason to actually have a proxy for the underlying question, which is can you locate them? Can you identify them and locate them? And what these proxies will end up doing is taking taking something that I view as being focusing on a use. We talk about orphan works, but I think technically we should be thinking about uses of orphan uses or something like that. What we'd be doing is taking something that should be focused on a particular use and what you do to get limitation of liability or whatever it's going to be, and it in these proxies turn it into essentially a work losing its protection for all time, for all uses. And that is a big problem. I view that what would be helpful to do from our perspective, which again is an owner and a user, is to make changes that essentially take what we do all the time, which is we look and we try to find someone, we go down this avenue, go down that avenue, and essentially take what our practices are, and instead of at the end of the day saying, no, you can't use it, say, well, you've done enough and now you can use it, but after having made that search.
I had Christine and then Chris and then Maureen.
If we have to incorporate the criteria of time, of when something was created, and also whether something is in print, published or not, then I think that the large part of visual art would be excluded from orphan works, because these are the two slipperiest slopes that we deal with. And we feel, and it's not just the visual art, it's also the photograph, it's the derivative work beyond the visual art. I mean, that gets even more complicated. And then all the repetition of the publication or the distribution of that, it wouldn't work at all. Now, I also want to bring up another point, and that is the commercial aspect, commercial, non-commercial. As a librarian, I very well understand our willingness to say, let's deal with the non-commercial because we're doing this for the common good, for the public good. But let's be realistic. Today's university situation, we're doing a lot of stuff that is commercial as well. And that starts to get us into areas that we cannot make blanket distinctions that everything that is being done within an educational institution is going to be for nonprofit. But we are in business. We are trying to make a living out of some of the stuff that we are holding and protecting. And also, within the arts, everything that an artist does probably has some commercial value. So that's another area that we can't really make a distinction between for-profit and not-for-profit.
Chris, then I have Michael, and then Maureen.
So the 25 or 28-year waiting period makes sense, I think, as part of a categorical system of the kind that Jewell discussed in his introduction, where, you know, at the end of that period, something has to happen. And if you comply as the author or the rights holder with that requirement, your work is, all the rights are preserved. If you don't, some of the rights go away. Okay, there's some limitation on ability, at least with respect to some uses for some period of time. All right. If we're going to have a reasonable effort system, I don't think personally that a waiting period makes sense. If we're going to have a reasonable effort system, then we just make the reasonable effort to locate the owner of the work. The Creative Commons and Save the Music approach, our espousal of a waiting period is really tied to the categorical system that we've recommended. Okay, that's first point. The second point, though, is that this, I think there was a comment by David about the use of proxies and what good is the use of proxies. I mean, in our view, and you know, people in Washington heard this, but there are some people here who weren't there, the most important benefit of proxies is that they make decisions cheaper. It's important to make the orphan works identification system as cheap as possible because many of these works have little economic value. That's why they're orphaned. That's why they've been abandoned by their owners. Many of the uses that are foreseen of these works may have tremendous social value, economic value, cultural value, but again, relatively little economic value. And as a result, in order to have these uses made, in order to have, you know, the orphan work system work well, the system has to be cheap to use. So that's why we think proxies, categorical system, makes sense. One specific response to David's statement that, you know, what we're talking about here is a loss potentially of all rights for all uses for all time. I don't remember of the people at this table anybody making a suggestion like that. Creative Commons and Save the Music certainly have not. We are talking about works having limited liability if they fall into the orphans category. We'll talk later about reclamation provisions. We wouldn't be opposed categorically to an approach that said, you know, a rights holder could later come forward and reclaim at least against uses prospectively, although we're not in favor of reclamation against uses that have already been made. But I just wanted to, you know, what's at stake here. What's at stake here is not a complete removal of property rights. It's a balancing of rights of users and of owners.
Michael.
Record keeping by the government, for whatever reasons, by the publishers, by the those who issue protected works, is that the process of discovering, of locating, identifying and locating first the work itself, then the owners. The owners may have been the original issuer or those who received it in some kind of transfer of ownership, is so fraught that rather than observing a 28-year or 25-year period of waiting and the condition of whether an object is in print, or is accessible and distributed actively, is the difference between some use by the citizens of the country, some benefit directly or indirectly to the country, or not at all. Observing the rule that one has to locate and then persuade the presumptive owner to be responsive puts us in a very, very bad place. The remedy, in part, is to have a quick takedown procedure based on the owners themselves identifying themselves, saying to those who would reissue, redistribute, transform the work, that they're the owners and they have some interest in it, and they're asserting that interest, and they want that new use, that new distribution, to be ceased without serious penalty. To the question of commercial, non-commercial, I really do understand that very well, and there may or may not be a way of explaining it. From our perspective, the perspective of folks who are librarians and we're publishers and owners of IP as well. At a certain point, the economic value of an object may have reduced itself to next to nothing. And the non-commercial use really refers to non-exploitative use of an object.
I would regard, for instance, the Google digitizing of works for distribution, for indexing and indicators online of where these words and phrases occur in works is non-commercial use. That's a non-commercial use of expression.
Maureen.
I'd like to make a couple of comments in response to things that have been said. I, sort of working backwards, I would like to also state it is difficult, even given the systems that we have in place, to find out who people are. Even using the Copyright Office website, which we've all done and we appreciate, it'd be nice if we could go back beyond 1978. We recognize that. In the museum world, I would say there are probably, if there are 50 museums in the United States that have lawyers or people on the registrar staff who actually really spend most of their day working on rights clearances and rights identity, that's probably a lot. There are maybe 10 lawyers that I know in museums nationwide who do this, work on intellectual property issues. Most of the museums in the United States, whether they're art museums or history museums, are very small and are really run by volunteer staff. These are the people who are sitting on enormous amounts of material and would like to make it available. Now, it would be nice to have a checklist and say, if you do these three things, you can assume, you can presume this is an orphan work. And I think for the purposes of non-commercial, non-profit, scholarly uses, whether print or electronic, whether it's going on the web, you kind of step back and say, well, where really is the harm? It gets even more minute when you're dealing with unpublished works, because then there really is, you don't even know where to go on that. You have no reason to believe there ever really was any. You don't have the issue of statutory damages because you don't believe it was ever registered by anybody. So under current law, you're already doing a risk analysis that sort of takes you to zero. On the unresponsive potential, maybe copyright owner, and whether you can draw a presumption from that, whether it's ambiguous, it would be nice to have some basic guidelines, thresholds. I don't think they can substitute for the due diligence that you would do. I think at a certain point you kind of know when you've run to the end of the path and you can't go any further based on your potential use and what you're doing. And so as much as I like the checklist and the guidelines, I think that can get problematic for, we're owners, we're users, and I think that can get to be a problem. But for scholarly works, I think the unresponsive copyright owner, potential copyright owner, just the fact that they're unresponsive or their answer is ambiguous does not mean that should be that is not an orphan work. I know there's too many negatives in that sentence. I apologize.
I'd like to explore a little bit the concept of guidelines in this sense. I'd like to explore a little bit the criteria and, I mean, criteria is not the right word, the factors that people believe should be considered when you're trying to determine whether a search is reasonable or not. We've heard mentioned a few of them. Question of the nature of the use, whether it's commercial versus non-commercial use. But let's think some more about all of the things that people think are relevant to determination of whether a search to find the owner was reasonable or not. I can think of some. There's commercial, non-commercial is a distinction, but we can explore the differences of that if people would like. But I think published versus unpublished might figure into that. But other factors that people think would be relevant if we were going down the path of determining guidelines and what kinds of things we should look at, or if we were thinking about the circumstances and factors that courts should, or whoever is deciding these issues, should look at when deciding whether what a particular user did in a particular circumstance, whether that was reasonable or not. I think Dwayne had his hand. Brewster.
One of the points that I wanted to make was the idea that there are ways to protect your rights now under copyright law. There is an existing registration system, and we haven't talked about that at all. And my hunch is that of all the works that are created on any given day, not all of them are registered. And I go out and do this talk all the time to folks and say, if it's important to you, spend the $30 and register it. So I don't want to leave this impression that there aren't ways for owners or copyright folks to protect their rights now, because I think that there are. And in fact, there are incentives in the law that are very powerful to encourage them to do that, and that still doesn't happen. In the same sense, I think you could say that about renewal rights. People were aware of the law and renewal opportunities, and they didn't do that. But to look at least newer than 1978 works where we have electronic records, registration might be an important factor in that kind of context as to whether there's an owner for it or not.
Brewster.
We unfortunately get to deal with this issue every day. And it really comes down to when we're talking with somebody that feels like we shouldn't have their web pages or some such. They're trying to figure out, are they being taken advantage of? And that's fundamentally underneath everything. And then all this law stuff, as best I can tell, being a non-lawyer, is all about what happens when you're pissed off. And so the key thing is to try to keep people from being pissed off. And so here are some of the factors in terms of what seems to, in the day-to-day life, when do people draw the line? Probably one of the biggest is whether it was sold in the first place. If it was never a commercial work, then they tend to say, well, I gave it away before. So that seems to be an aspect that seems to be useful. It seems to really depend by media type. By industry or some way of thinking of these. There's different cultures in music than there is in web pages, than as opposed to what the software guys call abandonware, which I think is a great term. Abandonware. So media type I find very important. Another is, did somebody do some level of work to assert something, whether it's a registry of formal or informal, whether it's with the Copyright Office or with some sort of DNS kind of things. Is there something that somebody actually did to assert that they care? In our case, in the web page world, it's whether they put a robot exclusion up. It's this simple file that is part of the culture of the web where you can go and assert something. You care. that seems to work. The other is years. If years go by, kind of, who cares? It's old stuff. So those are the aspects that we've found to be important towards understanding whether a work is going to cause people to be upset. Then the issues of what do you do with it. There's non-commercial. Let me just hit them briefly, even though it wasn't your question. There's non-commercial use. There's whether notice and takedown works. And is it for navigation? And is it for preservation? Because people will often be very inclined to have their things in archives just for that immortality thing, which is very real. So those sorts of aspects of the use tend to become very important. And to us, to finish my...
Oops. Let me just clarify. By navigation, you mean finding it on the web, finding something.
Finding aids. Exactly when does it become when does it stop to be a finding aid versus... If it's two lines of text about a web page, that seems to be okay. Then there was a debate around whether it's a thumbnail of an image. Okay, is it a clip out of a movie? You know, there are, of course, debates. But if it's fundamentally navigation as opposed to substituting for the work, that tends to make people feel much more comfortable with their works being used in that circumstance. And the last is actually from our perspective, is some form of limited liability. I mean, I talked to the lawyers, and the copyright law is pretty darn frightening as it currently stands. Thank you.
Barbara, Megan, then Joe.
Well, the producers and directors and filmmakers and studios and networks that I work for are not interested in ripping off people. They don't want to, you know, just use things arbitrarily, and we spend a great deal of time really trying to track down material and who the owner is. I mean, oftentimes I start at the Copyright Office, and I start with the bib book and looking to see who the current distributors are of documentaries and other films. And oftentimes that's very incomplete information. And then we spend the rest of the time literally calling and tracking down every known name, entity, production company. Does it still exist? Who bought it? When did they buy it? Was this film collection transferred at some point? To whom? Was it mortgaged at some point? Who now holds it? And it's an exhaustive process that literally goes around the world. And the filmmakers, they don't have, especially documentary filmmakers, and even the studios, they don't have unlimited time they want to spend doing this kind of research. And what they really want is to know, what can I do to try to, you know, some guidelines to say, okay, this is enough. When we try to do certain things with talent and try to clear talent, there's certain things what we can do to try to locate even talent that sort of falls within the realm of SAG and AFTRA, that, okay, that's great, we've done this, we've contacted, you know, the guild, and they don't have a contact, we sent out a letter. And if we had at least some minimum standards from which to follow, then if the person does step forward, we don't want the liability of them being able to charge anything that they can desire or have to go to a lawsuit and have to defend that. So the filmmakers, trust me, they really want to find these people, they want to pay them some money. They don't necessarily want to pay them $1 million, but they want to pay them a reasonable fee. We're paying somebody else this certain amount of money for this particular documentary, or we're using this motion picture, and the average price that we're paying everybody is probably a higher amount because it's a big film. But they want some kind of guidelines because they don't want to get into trouble. But at the same token, you have a director who really wants to include this little piece of footage, and it's an everyday task. It's very frustrating footage, and it's an everyday task. It's very frustrating sometimes when you really can't absolutely deny that they own rights to a particular film. Oh, no, this company owns it. No, we don't own it. Our rights expired. They own it, and nobody would, like, step forward to it. And in the meantime, well, gee, you know, we're shooting that scene in the next couple of days, and we really want to use that. So it's happened. So finally we just kind of ask both of them and say, well, can we just pay you both a little money, and you'll sort of settle it. But it can be very frustrating, so it would be really great to have some minimal guidelines that we can follow, that, because there's researchers all around the world who do this every day, so that we can feel safe in telling our producers and the studios that this is what we've done, and we have made reasonable efforts, and then along with the E&O people, they can decide that, yes, we can use this is okay, and if somebody steps forward, we can either pay them some reasonable set amount, or that they can't then sue you for using it.
Megan was next, and then Joe.
Nonprofit educational point of view, we produce foreign language materials for the government, and we use portions and amounts of texts or one or two of a number of photographs in our works. I think that one guideline that might be helpful could be possibly, in some cases, portions or amounts. And also number of requests. We've done this thing where we've written once and waited 3 weeks, and written again and waited 3 weeks and written again. And yet, because of the uncertainties and lack of having a clear guideline, we usually end up not using the work and trying to rewrite the material or find a substitute. I would also like to see something specific about nonprofit educational uses as a guideline or a criteria. Everything that we do immediately falls into the public domain, being produced by government employees during their working hours. So this is also another factor, the possible consequences of us using an orphaned work and it going into the public domain. A takedown is not necessarily that simple once the work has been distributed in this way.
Joe was next, and then Christine.
We talk about published versus unpublished. Can we go back to a professional photographer for a second, and maybe can you tell me what the interpretation of published versus unpublished, what's protected, what's not protected from a copyright stance?
Well, from current copyright stance for works since 1978, everything is protected, whether unpublished or not published. The questions of published versus unpublished become tricky when you go to works from the old 1909 Act, and that's where it becomes difficult. We heard last week the question of unpublished versus published work is very important to photographers,
right,
for example, because that's a critical distinction, especially for photographers who produce 1,000 images, of which only a handful will ever, in their view, be worthy of publication. Right. And then the question is, how do you deal with the other 990 or so that they believe are unpublished and they would not like to see be made public in any way? That's one of their important copyright rights, is that they profess to really take an important view of and want to have control over it. So that's
make sure I understand that the interpretation of published means that it's been released to somebody for some reason.
It depends. I mean, it's not an easy question to answer. I will admit that.
Well, you wrote the law. You ought to be able to figure it out.
If I did, I don't think I would claim a right of attribution on that right now. No.
Well, the reason I ask that, all joking aside, is that, you know, in a position we're in, it's one of those things where I think somebody brought up there are a lot of available avenues for somebody to pick for a copyright mark or to register it to a position. And, the issue we get into a lot of times is that the photographers from the professional photographers of America, their stance is they kind of hide behind that whole, well, we don't have to do that because we're protected under this piece of it. So we get into a little bit of play on words there and a little bit of, you know, hiding behind what is there, but then there are available avenues to put a stamp on it or to put some kind of identification to make it actually easier. And the reason I bring it up is because it's easier for some actually easier. And the reason I bring it up is because it's easier for somebody to go find the photographer goes into a different aspect than what we're talking about from Orphan Works. But if there was an identification,
I think it's relevant. I think what it may be similar to what Brewster was referring to as sort of assertions by the owner of contact information or just identifiable and, you know, their identification information that they make, whether it be a stamp on a on an image or something, that could be one of the factors that you consider about whether what reasonable search is. You know, I've told this story that I've had clients who wanted to use a photograph, and I asked them, did you see a notice anywhere on it of who the owner might be? And they say no, and then I ask them, did you turn the photograph over? And they say, oh, there's a notice here. and so I think that's one of the factors.
See, but I think what you get into, though, is, you know, 999 times out of 1,000, they're not putting anything on the photograph, and they're hiding behind the copyright law that says I don't have to, everything's protected, and it makes it extremely difficult for the average consumer to figure out where to go if they, you know, if they go back and try to find that photographer in their hometown phone book and it's not there, what do I do next? And I think that's really kind of where I keep going back to the ease of how does this average consumer who can't find it in a phone book, what's their next option? And I kind of like that idea of the checklist of saying, you know, if I can't find it, I need to go here next. And then if I can't do that, go here next. And then, you know, to that point, once the average consumer exhausts that list, or even the retailer for that part on our sense exhausts that list of things to do, I think at that point we got to say, all right, we can't find the person. And I think it's free will at that point where we've got to go ahead and satisfy the consumer for what they want. The other thing I want to make comment on, I guess from a criteria standpoint, is where does this fall into international copyright and how that plays out. And I'll just give you a real simple example that's very basic that we run into sometimes, and I know it's very simplistic, but people who go on cruise ships get their pictures taken. They come back, they want a copy of that picture from the cruise ship. Of course, the cruise ships are of international registry. You can't get a hold of the photographer. Forget that noise, and the cruise line won't even entertain the thought of answering the question. So you're now into a situation where we know clearly it's a professional picture. We're not supposed to copy it, but you do due diligence and, you know, forget it. There's no way you're getting anywhere on it. So I think from that standpoint, you may get into those kind of situations, too, where there are exceptions to the rule.